The Guardian.
Nova is America's most watched science series. You'll find it every night at 7:50 on PBS, Sky Channel 166, Virgin Media 243. PBS, where television matters.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week...
I was totally stunned in speeches. I gave a terrible acceptance speech in which I forgot to thank everyone.
I meet the winner of this year's Royal Society Winton Prize for Science Books, the author of The Wave Watcher's Companion, Gavin Pretor-Pinney. And...
there's a lot of basic science, a lot of understanding about what's going on in the disease process now. But there are still a disappointing number of clinical trials actually taking those treatments forward.
I speak to Professor Clive Ballard about the frontiers of our understanding of dementia and Alzheimer's disease. And Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample discusses his trip to the brainiest annual conference on the planet. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Now, last week we previewed the shortlist for this year's Royal Society Winton Book Prize for Great Science Writing. Our own Ian Sample was on the shortlist, but sad to say he was pipped to the post by Gavin Pretor-Pinney. I met up with Gavin after the ceremony, but first let's hear what the chair of the judging panel, Richard Holmes, had to say about the book.
The Wave Watcher. This is a lovely book. It's, in a sense, it's deeply eccentric. What he's done, this is the chap who wrote his first book, I think it was called The Cloud Watcher's Guide, which was a great hit, was simply about looking at clouds and all the things, the way you could define them, what they did. Here he takes waves, which actually is a much more complicated subject. And he starts simply, I think, with his little daughter on the beach looking, you know, the famous count, is the seventh wave bigger, etc. And from that, he begins to analyse what a wave actually is, which is not necessarily what you think. It's a form of energy travelling through water and so on. And then he goes, he takes this idea of waves and he looks at the world all around us. So it would include, say, quite human things like the Mexican wave, all right? And then fairly simple natural things like the movement of a snake, say, or the seven bore, that the wave of water that comes down the seven estuary in the West Country. And then he moves towards much more subtle things, towards electromagnetic waves and how those work. Very, very good descriptions of those. He uses eccentric little pictures and diagrams to explain this. And the marvel, I think, of this book, and it's quite, of all the books, it's a very poetic book in a curious way. It really made us all look at the world around us differently. And that was for all of us. There was one of our judges said, I was waiting for a bus and I started watching the water streaming down in the gutter and the way it was making little eddies and waves. And suddenly then I looked at the bus queue and I realized that was moving in a wave and so on. So it's a kind of visionary book, eccentric, visionary, and written with great passion.
Congratulations on your win. Tell me, was it expected?
Absolutely not. I mean, maybe people always say that about prizes, but you know, I was so kind of reconciled to the fact of not winning that I was very, very kind of relaxed coming along. I just thought, well, I'll try and do a nice reading, and we'll leave it at that sort of thing. So it's just, I was totally stunned in speeches. I gave a terrible acceptance speech, in which I forgot to thank everyone.
I'll come to your acceptance speech in just a moment, actually, because it was actually very interesting, despite what you say. But tell us what your book was about.
So it's about waves, but you know, when you hear that it's about waves, you immediately think of the ones on the ocean. And certainly it starts with those and it ends with those. But in between, there are all the other waves. Because, in fact, ocean waves are just a tiny proportion of all the waves that surround us. Sound waves, light waves, brain waves, Mexican waves. You know, the every beat of your heart takes the form of a muscular wave. They're actually, when you stop to look at them, and stop to think about them, they're everywhere around us. And for that reason, you know, the ocean waves is just the beginning. And, you know, it's like sort of pulling on a thread. Before too long, you know, one thing led to another. And I realized that I had quite a lot of research on my hands.
So basically you've used waves as a device to talk about lots and lots of interesting different things. Give us a couple of examples. You gave some in your reading that were quite fascinating.
Well, I mean, in the reading I talked about little waves that can travel between groups of individuals. So a Mexican wave is information traveling through the population. You see bees do versions of Mexican waves in Asia, where they have their nests, their hives outside, not enclosed, and they do these Mexican waves to sort of scare off hornets. You even see them down on the level of microorganisms communicating with each other in waves of chemical signals. So, you know, that's just, I suppose, one example. But even the most obvious, the ocean waves, when you stop to look at them, they're a little bit more intriguing than they might at first appear. You see an ocean wave coming in towards you at the shore when you're sitting on the beach on holiday. Looks like a kind of mound of water travelling along. But it's not travelling water, because if it was, that would be an ocean colour and it would all pile up on the shore. In fact, the water just goes in a circular path and returns to where it started. What's travelling is energy. And this is a sort of strange idea, that it's energy travelling from out at sea and arriving to the shore. Energy given to the water by the winds of a storm, say. You know, I just found, really what interested me was kind of looking at the everyday and realising that maybe there's more to it. Maybe we're so used to seeing the stuff around us that we've become blind to them.
You said when you were talking earlier about how waves are just, they transmit information and energy. They're not quite what you think, and they do appear everywhere. Is there something of a theme going on with your previous book? Was The Cloud Spotter's Guide. Mm. This is The Wave Watcher's Companion. I mean, do you want to try and find unexpected links in things that people might think of as quite difficult physics concepts?
Really, what I want to do is encourage curiosity and encourage people to look at what's around them, to find what's exotic in the mundane. Because, you know, there's a sense that, I suppose it's kind of perpetuated by the holiday companies or something like that. You have to get in a plane and you have to fly somewhere on the other side of the world to see something exotic, to see something surprising, to kind of be amazed. And I don't think that's the route to happiness in life. I think the route to happiness in life is finding the beauty and the kind of marvel in just the everyday stuff that's around you. And so both the books, the Cloud book and the Wave book, have really been motivated by that.
Thank you very much, and congratulations again.
Thank you very much.
For more information about the book prize, the winning book, and if you're quick, a chance to win all the books on the shortlist, go to guardian.co.uk/science. Now, once a year, the biggest brains in brain science morph into a super brain, more commonly known as the annual Society for Neuroscience Conference. This year, it took place in Washington, D.C. The Guardian sought out the biggest brain it could find to report on the conference, but she was not available. So they asked Ian Sample, and he said, well, can I say no? Ian, you've been in Washington for a week. This is the first time you've been to SFN. Just give us a bit of background on it.
So this is probably the biggest science, it might be the biggest science conference that takes place annually. There's 31,000 neuroscientists, neurologists, all people associated with some kind of brain research there, a lot of psychologists and all the rest of it. And it's incredibly broad. I mean, there's just sessions on everything. It must be a nightmare if you're trying to go to, you know, you can't go to everything. There's sessions going on that sort of clash with each other all the time. There's a poster hall that is vast. It's like the size of Heathrow almost. It's enormous, and they change over the posters every morning and afternoon. So the volume of material there is jaw dropping.
And I suppose it's an indication of just how exciting neuroscience is in the 21st century. We're always talking about it. So everything from fMRI scanners to sort of behavior and brain. Well, let's just jump in straight away into some of the stories you wrote. Now, we're going to start inevitably with the orgasm story, and I'll just get you to explain it quickly.
So this was a bit of research from a psychologist at Rutgers University, and he demonstrated what he said he was pretty sure was the first animation built up from fMRI scan images of a woman having an orgasm in an fMRI scanner. And he says the point of this is that if you can look second by second at what is going on in the female brain when an orgasm happens, can you then compare that kind of, you learn a lot about the connectivity of the brain, he would argue, and can you then compare that to women who might have anorgasmia, as they call it? I'm not sure how very common that is, but anyway, can you compare it to people who have problems with that to see what's going wrong, and can it become, in some sense, you know, steer your clinical direction?
And so is there any physiological purpose to it beyond sort of just understanding how the brain works?
Well, I say, I mean, really what he wants to do is, first of all, can you identify what part of the brain comes in when? And then when, you know, which pieces are then working simultaneously? How does activity build up and then come together for your crescendo moment? But he is already looking at comparing those scans with, he's also got male orgasm scans to compare with men who've had their prostates removed from prostate cancer to look at why they're not having orgasms, which I must admit, you'd imagine you could get from other ways because you know what nerves you've damaged when you've done that operation. I thought, maybe not. And he's looking at women who've, say, had hysterectomies to see, for, you know, similar issues. What is different in their brains when they try and have an orgasm, if they can't have an orgasm? I think there's another stage to this that's a bit more questionable as to whether you can use this to get anywhere. Can you use this to really help people? He thinks, you know, you can do that by getting people to try and change their brain activity themselves by seeing it themselves. But I don't know how effective it is.
Now, if any listeners want to know how long it takes to practice how to have an orgasm in an MRI scanner, you can go to our blog where Kate Sukel, who's a journalist, actually did this for a piece of research and has written about it there. The last time, Ian, you and I talked about female orgasms on this podcast, we got all sorts of abuse. So I'm going to keep that conversation completely silent now. Let's move on to something much more serious. Mirror therapy to help the pain of arthritis. This is a very interesting sort of it's almost a proprioception story.
Yeah. This is, I really like this, and it's not an immediately obviously sort of brilliant story actually, but I really like what's beneath it. So this is the idea, and it came out of a big research program from University of California in San Diego, where you use, a lot of work had been done there on using mirrors to try and help people who had missing limbs but pain in their phantom limb, using mirrors to alleviate that pain. And it's a really nice optical illusion you can do that can reassure your brain of what's really going on.
Just explain that one actually, because it is famous. It's something that people might have seen on TV or something. But
so you can have people who have, say they have an amputation below the elbow or at the elbow, so they won't have a forearm and hand, but they can feel pain in that part. So even though they don't have the limb there, they still feel pain. And it might feel like the hand is completely balled up and clenched all the time. Now what you can do is you can put a mirror in front of them, moving out from upright, moving out from their chest, that obscures their hand that's amputated, the limb that's amputated. And then they look in the mirror and you see that, and they can look at their other hand. So you see their normal hand and then a reflection of that normal hand. And you get them basically to open and close their hand normally and naturally. And the brain sees that and it thinks that the reflection is the phantom limb sort of thing. And because it sees it moving normally and calmly and all the rest of it, the pain can reduce in the phantom limb. It's kind of using an optical illusion to help the brain reassess what's going on and think everything's normal.
And in this particular research that you reported from last week, they've used this to help with the pain of arthritis.
Exactly. And there's an interesting thing in that, because the pain in arthritis, you can give someone a scan and look at arthritis damage, and there is real damage going on there. And so you'd think, well, will this technique work in arthritis? Because there is physical damage going on. Now, what is really interesting that they found a pain alleviating effect from this mirror therapy suggests that some of the pain you're feeling in arthritis is probably due to the brain thinking this limb isn't working, operating as it should be. All is not quite right. So almost gives you an extra level of pain there, which is just, it's like alarm signal saying things aren't right with this.
But your brain's only way of sort of communicating that to you is to make it painful.
Is to make it feel painful, yeah, on top of the pain that is genuine. And so you can alleviate that sort of extra stuff by using this similar kind of mirror therapy to reassure your brain, in a sense.
It seems too simple to be true, I suppose. But I suppose it shows you how little we know about how the brain creates pain in your head. I mean, it says all sorts of things about chronic pain too, and all sorts of other things. Because there is a physical reason, but there's got to be a psychological reason to it as
well. Yeah, it can be a double element thing.
psychologically, let's move on to the next story, junk food and hunger. Now, this is probably a bit familiar to most people who, if you've ever had a situation where you're starving and you're walking past a supermarket and you think, I'm going to get some dinner for tonight, and you suddenly walk out thinking, I would never normally eat all this stuff, the donuts and cakes and pies. I mean, that's just my normal shopping basket. But for healthy people, when they're hungry, they suddenly start buying all this rubbish. What happens?
So this is, I really like this study because you... say everybody's familiar with this idea that you come home with loads of stuff that you wouldn't normally eat, loads of cookies and buns and things when you're really hungry. Now, so what these guys started off by doing was when you're hungry, your stomach releases a hormone called ghrelin, and it wasn't quite clear how this works in changing your buying behavior. So what they did, they got a load of people to sort of rate how much they would pay for things, essentially, whether it's food or other stuff, when they were in a scanner, and they gave some of them saline, some of them ghrelin. And when you give someone an injection of ghrelin, they get ravenous for 1 or 2 hours. And you, in the experiment, you're saying you can eat what you buy. But there was a kind of complex bidding process that I won't go into. But the results of it basically show that when ghrelin is released in the body, you pay more. You will pay more for that, for whatever you want to buy, food-wise. But what's interesting about this is if you ask people what foods they like out of a list of, say, 20 things, and you give them, like, from apples through to carrots and, you know, and then all sorts of junk food, you tell people, ask people what to rate what they like the most. Okay, they will, if you then look at what they paid most for or what they buy a lot of when they're hungry, it's not the same pieces. It's not like you suddenly buy lots of apples and fresh fish. You go for high calorie, dense calorie foods when you're hungry. So you come back with rubbish food. And what's nice about this is it kind of feeds into that whole idea that you don't lose weight if you skip meals because you get hungry. And when you're hungry, you buy crap food. You don't buy healthy food.
Yeah, that's right. So if you miss 2 meals in a day, you don't end up just having a salad for dinner because you need to have chips or something.
And when you're in the queue, I experienced this when I was out there, maybe because I was just aware of it after interviewing the guy, and I was in a Starbucks and I was starving, and I was immediately just drawn to these big buns, and I was thinking, buns, 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 and I thought, what am I doing? I would like, you know, I should just eat something else. And
can you do anything about it? I mean, is there any sort of medical benefits to knowing this?
Just the knowledge. I think I was talking to the researcher about this, and he was saying just knowing that this is going on, just being having that information, you're aware of what's happening when you go in there. Just buy the normal stuff you would buy and try and buy healthy stuff.
So just willpower.
Yeah, you can override it. It's not, you know, but if you're not aware of it, then it'll probably happen without you realizing till you get home with your bags. And because you bought all that rubbish food, you're going to eat it.
So hopefully if you're listening to this and you feel stupendously hungry, just know that there's some hormones running around. So just take some deep breaths and buy some apples. Final story, Ian. This is perhaps an explanation for those nauseatingly happy people you see everywhere. And I say nauseatingly happy, I mean it's not exactly they're nauseating, but you know, they're just always happy.
Well, it's really a sort of a rose-tinted glasses explanation. These guys were trying to get to the basis of what the neural systems are at work, where you just have these people who just see the world, they have rose-tinted glasses. And what I loved about this is you get a bunch of people in a scanner to who you've rated beforehand on a standard test to see just what their kind of baseline happiness level is from 1 to 7. And these are all normal range people. These aren't sort of 1 is depressed and 7 is annoying. They're normal range. This is normal range happiness. And you show them images that are pretty nasty, like unhappy people sat in chairs or people pointing guns at each other. You show them neutral pictures, which will just be a pattern or something completely neutral. You show them positive pictures, which might be like a bunch of flowers or, you know, a basket of kittens or something. What's interesting about this is no matter how happy you are or how wherever you are on that happiness scale, you respond the same. A part of your brain called the amygdala, which is really involved in really early attention. What do you pay attention to in the environment? The activity in the amygdala is the same across the board, depending on no matter how happy you are, to negative and neutral things. Now, with positive things, the happier end of the scale, the happier people, they see positive things. They really see them. They really pay attention. They see positive things more than other people, and they respond more than other people.
So they're wildly happier.
So what they're doing, they're going around the world, and they're not oblivious to the fact that there are bad things going on. They're not naive and just thinking, seeing the positives in everything. But where there are positives to be had, they see them and they enjoy them.
So whereas you know, you might see a basket of kittens and go, yeah, basket of kittens, they'll be like, basket of kittens!
Exactly, exactly.
One of the inconvenient truths is that in the Western world, as our populations age, we're faced with an ever-increasing risk of neurological diseases, most commonly called dementia, and in particular the fatal disease Alzheimer's. I met up with Professor Clive Ballard, who's a scientist at King's College London and Director of Research at the Alzheimer's Society UK, to discuss where we are in our understanding of this disease, and where science is taking us in our attempts to stop it in its tracks. I started by asking him what kinds of drugs there are to treat Alzheimer's and other dementias.
We do have licensed drug treatments since the mid-1990s, but I think there are also a lot of other things in terms of giving people information, advice, allowing them to take control over decisions that also make a big difference to how well people can live with dementia. But in terms of the drug therapies, there are two main classes of drug that are licensed. One are called cholinesterase inhibitors, and the drug people are probably most familiar with is a drug called donepezil or Aricept, which is licensed for people with mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease. And there's another class of drugs with only one drug in it called memantine that's licensed for people with moderate to severe Alzheimer's disease. And in the UK, those are also both approved by the National Institute of Clinical Excellence for treatment. Those treatments give symptomatic benefit, so they don't necessarily alter the long-term course of the disease. But what they do, if you like, is they improve the, particularly cholinesterase inhibitors, improve the symptoms above the baseline level before treatment, perhaps for about 9 to 12 months, something like that. So it's not a miracle. We want far better treatments in the future, but actually what you're giving somebody, if you like, is nine months of better function than they had before they had the treatment. And from the time of diagnosis to death, the life expectancy isn't brilliant for people with Alzheimer's disease. It is a disease which accelerates mortality, and it's something like 4.5 years. So if you like buying somebody 9 months of better functioning out of 4.5 years, we'd want to do better, but it's actually not bad, and it is offering some people something positive. Memantine is slightly different because it doesn't actually improve symptoms, but it does slow down the rate at which they decline. And perhaps some of the key skills that people need to maintain as much independence as possible will be preserved a bit longer if people are taking memantine. And there's emerging evidence more recently that the combination of both of those treatments together gives people the best long-term protection and perhaps does slow down the rate of long-term decline.
But in terms of what's on the horizon, I mean, what other things, you said you would want to do better than those two drugs. What's sort of in the pipeline?
Well, I think if we're going to do better with drug treatments or other type of treatment approaches, they need to be therapies which give people longer-term benefit, and if possible, are treatments which could even delay or prevent the onset of the dementia, not just affect the symptoms once people already have the illness at that sort of severity. And there's a lot of basic science, a lot of understanding about what's going on in the disease process now. But there are still a disappointing number of clinical trials actually taking those treatments forward. And in fact, we only currently have 3 final phase clinical trials going on worldwide, focusing on people with Alzheimer's disease, which is, you know, really nowhere near enough treatments to actually have a really good chance of making that breakthrough within a timely period. And for any one drug development, it takes about 20 years to develop that individual drug. And any one drug that comes into final phase trials, probably about 1 in 10 of them will actually turn out to be an effective treatment. So you need a lot of investment in developing new drugs to actually get to the drugs that are really working for people. And that's why in cancer there's been so much success, because there's that large volume of trials which is delivering on a regular basis new and more effective therapies. The therapies that we do have in final phase trials at the moment are mainly vaccine therapies. So these are therapies which target the amyloid protein that begins to aggregate in the brain. And certainly we know that those therapies remove the amyloid from the brain. What we don't know yet is whether they actually give people clinical benefit in terms of their symptoms and their long-term disease course. And they are associated with some hazards as well. They do cause bleeding in the small blood vessels in the brain in about 5% of people. So I think those trials are awaited with a lot of interest. It's not yet at all certain whether they're going to be a benefit to people, but they're really important trials to do. A number of the other drugs which target the amyloid protein have been very disappointing and have failed in clinical trials. But I think there's a large school of thought at the moment that would be of the view that that's because the trials have been done too late in the disease process. Amyloid is a very early event in the disease. It's probably there in the brain in quite large volumes, before people even develop the clinical symptoms of dementia. So making a minor difference to amyloid once people have already got a brain full of amyloid might not be the answer. And what's beginning to happen now is the development of criteria using detailed neuropsychology to look at subtle memory problems combined with biomarkers, so either brain imaging to look at the volume of certain structures in the brain that are associated that diminish when people have Alzheimer's disease, or to look at markers in spinal fluid, for example, the proteins amyloid and tau, which are affected in Alzheimer's disease. It seems possible to actually identify people before they clinically develop dementia. So they have the Alzheimer's disease process going on, but they haven't clinically developed dementia. And that might be the group of individuals where some of these therapies targeting the amyloid are most likely to work.
I mean, does early diagnosis help?
Well, I think early diagnosis at the moment mainly helps people because it gives them the opportunity to receive information, to think about what they want, to take advanced directives, to have more control over their old illness. And I think all of those things are important advantages. But I think what's going to be even more important in the future is that once we do have therapies that can target that preclinical stage of the disease before people have the full-blown symptoms of dementia, it's incredibly important to have the technology to make the diagnosis at that stage so that people can actually benefit from those treatments.
Now, what about the basic science of understanding and treating Alzheimer's again? I mean, we've talked about the drugs are available now, the understanding we have now. Where are the challenges for your research field? What are the few things that your colleagues and yourself, what are you looking at?
Well, we've talked a little bit about sort of amyloid. One of the other major targets is the protein called tau in the brain, which tends to tangle in the nerve cell skeletons. And there are one or two therapies in development to try and stop that tangling process or to reduce that. That's been far less of a focus than for amyloid, but there are now a few therapies beginning to emerge, and that might actually be quite promising. There are also therapies being developed looking at more of what you might call a regenerative sort of approach, and I guess the best known of those is stem cell therapies. And cells with similar properties to stem cells have been used with some success in people with Parkinson's disease.
So what would these stem cells be doing in that situation?
Well, stem cells are cells which can develop into any type of cell. So if you have a what's called a neural stem cell, a stem cell from the brain, it can turn into any type of brain cell. And the original hope, the original aim of these therapies was that they might be able to replace some of the lost nerve cells that are dying as part of the disease process. But I think what we're beginning to understand is that a lot of the positive effect of the stem cells might not be directly to do with replacement of nerve cells. It might be due to the fact that when you put the stem cells in the brain, they trigger a reaction in the brain which leads to the release of a lot of protective factors which support other nerve cells and help them function and survive better. And it might actually be that kind of huge surge effect on those protective factors which is actually giving the benefit. And if so, that would be very exciting because that would actually make it much, much easier to administer the therapies in a way which was giving people the benefit. And I think we probably do need to do a little bit more work with rodents to understand some of those mechanisms. But actually, I don't think we're very far at all away from being able to do safe and sensible trials in people with Alzheimer's disease to see whether this actually could be a realistic treatment approach in the future.
So it's not the traditional sort of stem cell idea where you regrow whatever's damaged and replace it. It's more that the effect of the new cells is beneficial to everything else around it. How close are you to potentially putting these into people?
Well, there are now stem cell lines which are of what are called human-grade stem cells, which have been approved by the appropriate authorities as being safe and appropriate to use in humans. And those are cells which are human cells which haven't used any animal growth factors as part of creating those cells in the laboratory. And obviously, there's big ethical advantages of using stem cell lines that have been grown in that kind of way because it doesn't require cells from embryos or anything that causes those sort of ethical issues. So I think the fact that those cells are now available is excellent, and they have been used successfully in some brain diseases, and there's an ongoing trial in people with stroke at the moment, for example, and safety actually seems to be very good. And obviously safety concerns concerns are whenever you try any new therapy in people, the safety concerns are the first concern. But if these cells, as appears to be the case, are actually safe, then I think that will open the door to actually beginning to use them in other conditions. And I think that, combined with our increasing understanding from the animal studies of some of the issues about where to put the cells to get the best benefits, or where to put the cells in the easiest possible way that reduces the risks or the complexity, I think will allow us to move forward quite quickly.
I mean, this disease around the world is going to get more and more common, and it's difficult to understand and to treat already. I mean, there's obviously advances that you've talked about. How optimistic are you that we're going to, I don't want to say get on top of it, but, you know, sort of be successful at dealing with it in the way that perhaps we've been successful at, you know, other things like cancer and other equivalent sort of population level disease?
I think how we tackle it and how quickly we tackle it really depends largely on how seriously governments take it around the world. At the moment, in terms of research funding, it's the poor relation. It's tenfold less funded than cancer, for example, and manyfold less funded than many other serious diseases. And I think the classic example, in a way, is HIV. Which in the 1980s was considered as a complete killer disease that was untreatable, and, you know, it was thought that there was never going to be a solution to it. And yet, with the appropriate level of investment, within a generation or so, actually there are now very, very effective treatments that control that disease amazingly well. And I think exactly the same thing is perfectly possible for Alzheimer's disease with the right level of investment. I think we're beginning to know an awful lot about the disease. We can always know more, but it needs a tremendous amount of investment to actually begin to translate that knowledge into potential therapies and to investigate whether they actually work.
A big thanks there to Professor Clive Ballard. For more information on Alzheimer's disease and other dementia, go to the Alzheimer's Society website, alzheimers.org.uk. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time, of course, on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
Nova is America's most watched science series. You'll find it every night at 7:50 on PBS, Sky Channel 166, Virgin Media 243. PBS, where television matters.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.